This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Who's the little lady who's as dainty as a dream? Who's the one you can't forget? I'll give you just three guesses. Annette, Annette, Annette.
Annette Funicello was the most popular Mouseketeer on the Mickey Mouse Club. Her popularity outlasted her adolescence. After the Mouse Club ended in 1958, Annette had pop hits and then starred in beach blanket movies. Then she left show business to raise her children, and we saw her mostly on Skippy peanut butter commercials. In 1987, she starred in a send-up of her own beach movies, Back to the Beach. That same year, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Now she needs a walker at home and a wheelchair when she travels. That doesn't stop her from getting around. She's on the road now to promote her new autobiography, A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. I spoke to Annette Funicello earlier today and asked her first about the state of her health.
Well, you know, I feel terrific, and to see me from the waist up sitting, you'd never know anything was wrong. The problem is with my legs, the nerve endings, and the muscles are getting weaker. And there's really not much I can do about it.
Can we do some reminiscing like you do in your book?
Sure.
How were you picked to be a Mouseketeer?
Well, I was dancing at a little school recital, and Mr. Disney, unannounced, was sitting in the audience. And he saw me dance, and I guess liked what he saw. And he called, I guess there was a phone number of my dancing school in the back of the program. And he got in touch with my dancing teacher to see if I could come in for an audition. And that's really how it all started.
You must hear this all the time, but, you know, I grew up watching the Mickey Mouse Club, and of course, like every kid who watched it, I wanted to be a Mouseketeer. And I remember one of my neighbors, who was about my age, you know, she was a girl, one day I saw her and she had these mouse ears on, and I thought, oh God, I'm so jealous. She's a Mouseketeer now. How did she manage to do this? And of course, I later figured out she just probably went to Disneyland or something and bought them. But, you know, those mouse ears were such a status symbol when you were a kid. How did you feel the first time you saw the mouse ears and put them on?
Well, it was a shock, because I think the first thing we thought, especially the boys, was, what do you mean I have to wear those things on my head?
Yeah, they were really stupid looking.
Yes, and it ruined the boys' pomp.
Right.
So it was quite a shock to us, especially since you don't have any idea about a premise of a show called The Mickey Mouse Club. It was weird.
True. This is TV was still in, kids' TV was still in its infancy. Disneyland,
yes,
was just getting started. So
yes.
What were the mouse ears made of?
They were beautifully made. They were the finest quality felt, and the ears were wired so they didn't flop around. And the girls had beautiful red satin bows. And we used to bobby pin them on. And they were very expensive. I mean, in those days, I guess they cost about $50 each. And if we accidentally laid them down on the set and couldn't find them anymore, they came out of our pay.
Were you ever in that position? Did you ever get fined?
I lost three pairs of ears. And yes, they came out of my pay. So we made sure that we left those bobby pins in and didn't lay them around anymore.
What were some of, what was the code of conduct for the Mouseketeers?
Well, I think with anyone who works at the Disney studio, it's kind of an unsaid, unspoken understanding. You're just a nice person, morally and physically. You just respect everyone there so much, especially Mr. Disney. I respected the man so much, and I had such great admiration for him.
I found it amusing in your book. You said you had to call all the adults aunt or uncle, so the makeup person became Uncle Makeup, and the hairdresser became Aunt Hairdresser.
Exactly. That's the way it was, and we didn't think anything of it. I mean, it was natural for us because we were a family.
Annette Funicello is my guest. She's written her autobiography. It's called A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. Did the Mouseketeers have boyfriends and girlfriends in the club? Did you have boyfriends in the Mouse Club?
Oh, you bet we did. I was crazy about Lonnie. Lonnie was a gorgeous blonde-haired boy with the great pompadour and a good dancer, an excellent singer, and I thought he was the most suave, debonair man I had ever met. And we went steady, and I think each Mouseketeer girl had her favorite guy that probably went steady with.
How did Mr. Disney feel about this?
He didn't know. No, it was all good, clean fun. And, you know, there was no reason to tell him anything like that.
Well, he probably would have disapproved, don't you think?
Oh, I don't think so. No way. We were just such good friends, and we always had good, clean fun. And I think Mr. Disney approved of just about everything we did.
What was your favorite day of the week? Let's see, Friday was Talent Roundup Day.
That was my favorite.
Oh, okay.
I loved it. I was always interested in horses and, you know, being a cowgirl. And it was great fun. All the days of the week meant something. We had different themes. Monday was fun with music. Tuesday was guest star day. Wednesday was anything can happen day. Thursday was circus day. And then Friday was my favorite, talent roundup day.
I really envied you being able to wear the cowgirl suit. I desperately wanted to be a cowgirl when I was growing up.
Weren't they great outfits?
Yeah, yeah, they really were.
You know, they were. And those cowboy hats and the boots we wore, everything was done in such good taste.
You write that you got so much fan mail, yet early on in the Mouse Club, you didn't know it because Disney kept a lot of those letters from you. He didn't want you to know how much you had caught on. Why didn't he want you to know?
Well, I think the first year especially, even into the second year, some Mouseketeers were getting more than others. So he didn't want any of us, I guess, to feel superior to any of the others. He didn't want any jealousy. And I think he was always so wise in every decision he made.
Were you disappointed when the Mouse Club ended?
It was the most devastating day I have ever had to go through. To say goodbye to people that you had worked with on a daily basis for three seasons, and you have friends like your siblings, it was awful. We girls were madly in love with our director, Dick Darley, and to have to say goodbye to him was more than we could bear. It was awful.
After the Mickey Mouse Club, when you stayed under contract with Disney, he had you start a recording career, but you didn't think of yourself as a singer. Was it very intimidating for you to be in a recording studio?
Well, I had been trained as a dancer and never as a singer, so I was uncomfortable singing always. Even when I had my first audition, and he loved my little ballet number, my tap number. And then he asked me to sing, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't sing. And I never had in public before. And he said, surely you can sing a couple of bars of something. And I had a favorite song on the radio, at that time, and I sang that. So I was as comfortable as one could be, hating every minute of it. But I was familiar with the song, and he seemed happy with it. And he said, thank you very much. And I could tell by the smile on his face that he wasn't turned off by it. So I guess I wasn't as bad as I always thought I was.
Well, you had a recording career right after the Mickey Mouse Club. So why don't we hear the first hit that you had? And this is Tall Paul.
Chalk on the sidewalk, writing on the wall. Everybody knows it. I love Paul. Tall Paul, tall Paul, tall Paul. He's in my arms. Chalk on the sidewalk,
chalk on the sidewalk.
Dishes on a tree,
dishes on a tree.
Everybody knows.
That's Annette Funicello, Tall Paul. Now, you didn't think of yourself as much of a singer, and there was what has come to be known as the Annette sound.
Yes,
that was
right.
Created in part to compensate for the fact that you were still a girl and you didn't have a real, like, singer's voice. What was the sound?
Well, Tutti Camerata, who was my musical conductor, knew how uncomfortable I was, and he said, I'm going to try something new. It's never been done before. I would sing the first time, and then I'd sing to myself, and then they would add a lot of echo chambers to it. We came up with the Annette sound, and it made my voice much stronger, and I felt much more confident with the echo chambers. So it was a good sound.
Annette Funicello is my guest. She's written a new autobiography called A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Annette Funicello is my guest. She's written an autobiography called A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. It was during the period that you were, you know, having, recording pop tunes and on the road with Dick Clark. You started a romance with Paul Anka. So did he write songs that were about you?
Yes, well, he had the big hit song, Puppy Love, and it was a great song. We were sitting in my mom and dad's living room one night, and we were talking about our romance and how crazy we really were about each other, and he said, what a shame everyone calls it puppy love. They don't know how we really feel. And I think he said, that's a great title for a song. Let me work on that. So he just sat at our piano and kind of fiddled around. And I guess later he went on to finish the song, and it was one of his biggest hits.
That must have been fun. Someone tells you how much they care about you, and they go, oh, excuse me, that's a great idea for a song. And then they leave you to go sit at the piano and work it out.
But that's the way Paul was. You know, he would think of songs at the most inopportune moments. He was a genius. I think he was really so far ahead of all the other pop singers. He was always more adult, had greater goals in mind. He didn't want to do just rock and roll shows.
During your recording career, you also started making your beach blanket movies. Those were not Disney movies. How did Disney feel about you, you know, wearing two-piece bathing suits in beach blanket movies?
Well, he had full script approval. Of course, I was on a loan out from Disney Studio at the time. He read the scripts. He liked them a lot. He came up to me one day and said, I want you to have fun with these. They're good, clean fun. I have a request to make, a special one, and see what you think of this. He said, I know all the other girls will be bikini clad. I would like you to look different. And would you mind not exposing the navel? So in other words, he didn't want me to wear an out-and-out bikini. And of course I didn't mind him asking me that. I respected him so much. And so many years later, that's kind of the running gag. Does Annette have a navel? Why did he ask her to do that? He was just so right on so many things.
Now, you had traveled most of your career up until this point with a chaperone of one sort or another, a parent or a tutor. During the Beach movies, was the chaperone era over for you?
Oh, yes. It only lasted till I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on my own. But, you know, my mom or my dad or a friend would accompany me. I never traveled alone.
Was that good or did you want to cut loose?
No, that was very good. Because you have to, especially a lady, has to have someone with them for companionship, if nothing else.
You left performing when you started to have children. Did you feel you were able to have a quote, normal life after a whole childhood and young adulthood of being in show business?
You mean once I got married?
Yeah, once you got married and decided to leave show business for a while. I don't know how much of a normal life, so to speak, you were able to regain for yourself, well, since you were already pretty famous.
Well, I already knew up front that when I got married and started raising a family, that was going to be my number one priority, and it always was. Show business, I just sort of gently got back into it because a pal like Dick Clark would say, I'm doing a big special and could you appear on it? Please, could you just do me one favor? And then others heard that I had done that and asked if I would please do a show for them. So it was a very gradual kind of thing because people probably should have forgotten me. And I was so lucky that they never did. I think it was the name Funicello that stuck in their mind.
When did you start experiencing the symptoms of MS and realize that something was probably wrong?
When I was doing Back to the Beach.
That was 1987.
Yes. Yes, we did it in January and February. And there was something different. I had never experienced tingling in my fingers and my toes before. And I couldn't walk on the sand very well. And of course, that's not easy to do at best. But I knew there was something wrong, and I couldn't explain it.
When you found out that you had MS, it was several years afterwards that you decided to actually tell the public about it. But, I mean, even early on, you withheld the information from some of your family and some of your close friends. Why didn't you want people to know?
Because I didn't want anyone to worry about me.
Or to feel sorry for you?
Yes. I didn't want pity. That was very important to me. I just thought if I hit it, it might go away. And I walked with a cane, and I was lying. Every day I was telling a different story.
What kind of stories would you make up to explain the cane and the other problems you were having?
Well, that I had dancer's knees. It finally caught up with me. The old tendonitis set in. And, you know, I would always hold my left leg. But sometimes I would forget and hold my right. And people would say, but I thought it was your left. I mean, I was getting caught up in this pack of lies. And I realized when you lie, you have to remember. And I wasn't. So I knew it had to end. Soon, I had to do something about it because I wasn't happy.
Was it a relief when you started telling the truth?
Oh, it was like such a weight was taken off my shoulders. I felt so much better. I got rid of that ghost in the closet. It was awful. It was awful because I thought I was hiding it well enough sometimes, but then I'd slip up. And the old tendonitis story wasn't working.
What has the experience of reliving your past to write this book been like?
Well, I would say three quarters, even more, 99% of my past is full of such wonderful memories. I mean, too numerous to even mention. This last bout that I've had really threw me for a loop for a while.
The bout with MS, you mean?
Yes. And, you know, I've learned to accept it. You have to accept it because I want to be able to fight it. I want to keep up my strength. I don't want to give in to it. And I want to keep a smile on my face for others, too.
Do you think that whole thing of having to, of wanting to keep a smile on your face has something to do with the Annette persona? You know, the public Annette.
Yes. I know it has everything to do with that because I don't want to disappoint anybody. And I basically am a happy person. I'm not putting on any airs. I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm a happy person.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It has been a great pleasure.
Annette Funicello has written her autobiography. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.